Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Breaking the Silence, and we are live from Houston, Texas, the most beautiful city in the world. And wow, isn't it amazing? You can tell we're getting to the fall season because just a few weeks ago, the sun was just starting to go behind Texas Children's Hospital and MD Anderson here at the Texas Medical Center. Now the sun's already down, so we're at nighttime already. But welcome to the program tonight, and I just hope and trust and pray that this next hour is going to be able to give you a few, not only pieces of information, but inspiration. Also give you some education that you can actually take to make a positive impact on people's lives. And tonight we're going to be talking about probably a major portion of my heart with kids. And we're going to be talking about youth tonight. So call everybody and tell them, hey, get on BBS Radio and watch the show tonight because this is going to be a good one. We have an awesome, awesome guest tonight from the wonderful state of Ohio. So we'll let you know about that here just in a minute. Next week, you won't want to miss next Sunday night, 8 p.m. Central Time right here. We have probably one of my favorite people in my entire life. James Brown is going to be here from Illinois, and he was in my youth group years and years and years ago, and that was back in the dinosaur days, and he is going to come on and talk about some of the things that he's been battling with in his life, how he's become victorious over it, and how he's going to use those experiences in his life to change other people's lives. And isn't that what it's all about? Is when something negative impacts us and just gets us in the gut and knocks us down, that when we stand up, we not only overcome it, but we also reach down and grab somebody else that's getting ready to go through that experience or involved in that experience at the time and say, hey, let me help you. And I always like to look at it as we're on a long journey together. And along that highway, as we walk down it, we can literally see people that have dropped off into the ditch, dropped off into fields that they never thought they would be in because of something that's happened to them, because of a death, because of an abuse, because of an alcohol problem or an addiction. And us that have been down that journey before, it's time for us to stop, reach out and grab their hand, say, hey, let me take you as far as I can with you and let me show you what I've learned to be able to deal with that. And tonight, we're not going to only just talk about a problem. We're going to talk about people that are making a difference to help solve the problem. And tonight, we're going to be talking about child abuse. Tonight, we're going to be talking about some tough things. We're going to be talking about something that I think is a piece of my life and chapters of my life in the past. And my sons will tell you that they grew up a few of their years in a residential foster care environment because my wife and I were foster parents. And we love the foster care system. And tonight we are honored to have with us from Ohio, Dave Paxton. And Dave Paxton is a LISW. And I don't know what that means, but he's going to tell us. But he is the chief clinical officer for a wonderful network, and it's called the Village Network in Ohio. And for over 70 years, the Village Network has been serving and taking care of abused and neglected children in residential programs, in treatment foster care, and outpatient programs. And folks, between me, you, and the doorpost, this is so needed right now. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to dig really deep. I really want him to tell you more about him because he knows more about him than I do. So I just want to welcome from Ohio, Dave Paxton. Dave, are you there? Can you hear me?
I am here. Hey, I am here. Thank you for having me.
Good to see you this evening. Welcome to the program. And congratulations, Grandpa.
Well, thank you.
So brag a little bit. Dude, is this your first grandchild? Or
this is our first grandchild born today, a little girl.
Yep. Wonderful. And what'd they name her?
Lucy.
Lucy. You know, I I have a granddaughter, and Curtis is watching our Facebook page tonight, my son in Sugar Land, Texas. Him and Melissa had a child last year, and her middle name's Lucy because we love I love Lucy. Lucy Obama, that's why they named her that. But, well, congratulations, and I'm sure your wife are just ecstatic.
We are, we are. Lucy Yenner, she's born to my daughter and my son-in-law in Boise, Idaho today. Everyone's healthy but tired.
I bet.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a blessing.
Well, that's great. You know, it doesn't get any better than being a grandparent.
I've been told that. So far, it's been about 9 hours for me, and so far, it's okay.
Hey, okay. Well, you'll like it. You'll like it. There's nothing better than being called grandpa either.
That's what I hear.
Joe Hendershot had given me your name, and I'm so glad he connected with us. And when I got on the website of the Village Network, I found not only it being informational, but I saw the heart of what you folks do there. So tell me, first of all, we're just going to take our time. We have the whole hour. But tell me about you, Dave. What is it that you do? How did you get involved in this? Is there a backstory at all? Just tell me a little bit of what you do during the day.
Sure. So I am the Chief Clinical Officer. So my job at the Village Network is to help assure that our clinical models that we've chosen to work with for these children and their families, that these clinical models are in fact implemented as they're designed to be implemented, to fidelity, as they call it. Okay. There is a science to mental health, and we are a flagship organization of Dr. Bruce Perry's, who is the co-creator of the neurosequential model of therapeutics, and it's all about the neurosciences. And we are also working with Dr. Ablon from Think Kids out of Harvard, and he is the co-creator of an approach called the collaborative problem-solving approach. So my job is to, and with all of our clinicians we have, our mental health clinicians, to help them, support them, a lot of training, a lot of feedback on making sure that we're implementing our models as we want them to be implemented.
You know, I think both of those models you picked, I don't know who was actually involved in picking those two models, but you picked probably the two best that's out there. Both of them are very highly respected and honorable models. And so it's your job to just make sure everything that's done in the facilities and with the children fall into the scope of what those models project and teach?
Correct. And to make sure that to help our staff meet the needs of the children. You know, yeah. We work with children who have a lot of challenges, and we have an amazing group of staff that meet the needs of these children every day. We serve about 7,500 kids a year.
Wow.
And all of them with unique challenges. And more than anything, we want to make sure that we're keeping them safe and meeting the needs of where they're at.
Isn't that the truth? Those 7,500, are we talking about just Ohio children that you guys are dealing with?
We're mainly in Ohio. We have a few programs in the panhandle of West Virginia. Okay. Early childhood mental health, preschool programs, Head Start programs. We're serving as consultants to some Head Start programs, but mainly in Ohio.
Now, you mentioned something, because I always like doing this. I always like listening to actually what you say. And each of the children and the youth have a unique Bill in them. They're wired uniquely. How important is any way that, whether we're grandparents or we're parents or we have neighborhood children or we're teacher in a school, how important is it to understand that every child is different and very unique in the way they handle things, deal with anxiety, deal with happiness, deal with things in life? How important is it to understand the uniqueness of the way each child is created?
Yeah, it's really important, and it's an important topic in our field, in the mental health field. Delivering individualized treatment is very, very important. For each of us, not just our clients and the kids, but for each of us, who we are today, we got here through a unique pathway, through unique experiences. And each of the children that we work with, each of them had unique experiences, unique pathways, how they got to our doorsteps. Their families have unique pathways and experiences, and we need to respect those pathways and how they got to where they're at. And it's hard work to understand each child is different. And that's what makes our work so challenging, is that each child is unique. And each child does have a unique set of needs and wants. And it's very important to understand that, for example, we always talk about at the Village, it's so important for everyone to feel safe.
Oh, yeah.
If children don't feel safe, it doesn't matter what clinical approaches we're using. And if our staff don't feel safe, and if our foster parents don't feel safe, the teachers don't feel safe, if we don't feel safe, it doesn't matter what we're doing. Everybody has got to feel safe. But here's what's interesting is the children who are abused and neglected, they define safety different from you and I. Everyone defines what is safe differently. And that's the key, is understanding what helps them to feel safe, wow, what triggers them so they don't feel safe.
Yeah, we're going to drill a lot deeper into that issue. Dave, how did you get involved in this kind of work? Because I'm not for sure. There may be people that are in high school and go, hey, I want to be in foster care systems to be able to help kids. But did something happen? Did you perceive something? Did you see something? Was it an experience that you had? Did your mom and dad have foster kids? I mean, how did you get interested in this type of work?
Yeah, so I went to DePaul University in Chicago.
Wow, good school.
Back in the heyday of Ray Meyer and the basketball.
Oh, yeah.
But started grad school at University of Chicago, the School of Social Service Administration. And I was on my own. I needed a job. So I went and I found this ad in the paper for Maryville Academy out in the suburbs of Chicago. It was a large residential program. At that time, it was a state-of-the-art facility. I started out as a child care worker, working with children in a residential program who abused and neglected kids. Exposed to tremendous violence. But what intrigued me about their work was a couple of things. One was they had a model that worked. They had a model that that helped the staff frame the children's problems so that we can approach the kids in a respectful way. But the other piece of it was that respect. These kids have incredible backgrounds, horrible backgrounds. Some of them just have been through some tremendous things. But my goodness, the bravery they have and the courage that they show every day to get up every day and do what they do to get through the day, is just a level of respect that is due there. And that really drew me to that work. It's inspirational every day to see the kids struggle through their problems. But at the end of the day, they want to do well. Dr. Ablon from the Child Trauma, from Think Kids, and the collaborative problem-solving approach, he has a saying that kids do well if they can. And in fact, these kids, despite their challenges, they want to do well. And we have to figure out what's getting in their way. And figuring out what's getting in their way and then helping them overcome what's getting in their way really is intriguing to me and challenging to me.
With what's going on in today's world, 2020 has been a different year than nobody could have ever written in a book, and they could have sold that as fiction 5 years ago. that this is what we would look like today. What kind of impact has that made on Village Network? But more importantly, what kind of impact has that made on kids in our country, and specifically our country, but we have people who listen around the world, but just kids in general, what has this stress done to the environment that the kids are being raised in right now?
Yeah, what you said, the stress, exactly what it is the stress. I mentioned the safety is the most important thing. The other piece of it that has really is very impactful about this pandemic is relationships. You know, that what they say, make sure you're social distancing. These children need relationships and they need contact. So I think it was Dr. Perry that said, while we're social distancing, remain emotionally close. Remain emotionally close. Whether it's an email or reaching out through a Zoom meeting, these children need relationships. And so we at the Village suddenly found ourselves going from, you know, providing mental health services face-to-face live in our outpatient programs to suddenly doing it virtually, providing remote mental health through Zoom and other platforms.
And on a scale of 1 to 10, how effective is that? How adaptive have you been able to be able to keep that emotional connection?
It's working. Our staff have done an amazing job shifting over to the virtual mental health. And the foster parents and the staff have just been amazing with it. But I think to answer your question is it's the relational piece that's been the most impacted by what's going on. The relationships with the parents and the foster parents and the children and the relationships between the staff and the kids.
Okay, so take me through, because I remember when we had foster children in our home, we would have to meet once a week or once every other week, every other weekend with one of the parents. We would go to a local McDonald's or something, and we would have to supervise, but we would leave the kids there, and we would go over to the corner and eat our fries and drink our soda and kind of keep an eye on them while they would talk or go into Playland or whatever. How has that changed with everything? Because you're not only a residential, you have the outpatient and all of that, what's going on outside. How has the visitation with the real parents been damaged?
Yeah, at first visitation was canceled completely.
Oh my.
Because nobody was sure where this was going. Visitation has since resumed. So visitations are taking place with masks on, social distancing, taking temperatures. So every time people come into our buildings, their temperature is being taken. And the masks, it's odd to see visitations taking place with masks on.
Are they allowed to embrace their parents?
As long as we know that they haven't had any symptoms for the last, 2 or 3 weeks, no temperatures. As long as we know they haven't been exposed to anybody with the COVID, sure, they're allowed.
Okay. Wow. I remember how gut-wrenching those meetings were when the parent wouldn't show up or something was said or done, and then the foster child was handed back to us and they wouldn't see their parent again for another week or two.
Yep.
That is such a, I don't think normal kids in a normal family environment understand what that's like.
Right. Yeah, you're exactly right. I had mentioned to you before the show began, in Ohio, we have 15,000 kids in foster care. And each one of those 15,000 kids have a family. They have a family somewhere. And they need that relational piece with their family in some way or another.
Wow. I tell you what, we're going to take our first commercial break. If anybody wants to call in tonight, 888-627-6008. David and I would just love to hear from you and get a comment from you, whether you're from Ohio or anywhere else in the country. We have listeners tonight in Maine, I know. We have people in California and Florida and just all over the country. Connecticut, I was talking to some Connecticut people this afternoon. They're listening tonight. in Illinois and just all around the country. So if you want to call in, 888-627-6008. And on the other side of this break, Dave and I are going to go into what is child abuse, neglect in our country, and what has it looked like in the last few years, and what is the next few years going to look like if we don't get a handle on this. So don't move. Call somebody and tell them to tune in. We'll be right back for the next segment of Breaking the Silence right after this commercial break. This couldn't be coming at a better time. Have you ever felt like you were just trapped and couldn't find your way out of darkness? Have you ever felt like you were drowning and fighting to find your next breath? Well, coming in 2020 will be the second of a three-part trilogy, my new book, Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope. This new book will provide you a step-by-step approach of how to reach that destination, that important destination called hope. Now, two additional resources are going to be made available when this book is released. One, The Map to Hope. It'll be a handy guide that you can carry around with you, put in your briefcase or put in your purse. And this guide is going to help you find your way when you're stuck in life looking and searching for hope. And then the other resource, the Overcoming the Darkness Companion Journal. I have always believed that journaling is the first step to finding real healing and hope in your life, and this journal will guide you down that path. I'm excited about these resources and this new book that's going to be released in 2020, the Summer of Hope. Now back to the next segment of Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams right here on BBS Radio. Welcome back, and we have our awesome guest tonight, David Paxton, a Chief Clinical Officer of the Village Network in the wonderful state of Ohio with us tonight. What city, David, is that in Ohio?
Well, we are, the main corporate headquarters are in Wooster, Ohio.
Okay.
And then we have locations all throughout Ohio. We have
wonderful.
Yeah, we're spread out throughout the state. We have about 16 different foster care networks.
Wow. And,
residential programs.
Fantastic. If you want to call in or have a comment or a question, just want to get involved in the conversation, 888-627-6008. You may even want, and that's going to be our plea before we close this out tonight, that there's a need for foster parents right now. And David, has that need exploded since this pandemic? Is there a greater need now than there was 6 months ago?
It is. It has. And along with that, they're anticipating, as we get a handle on the pandemic and things start to open back up, the fear is that there'll be much more of a need for foster care and children's mental health services.
Is that because the children are being quarantined in their home and
yes,
there's more abuse going on?
Yes, that's the fear, yes.
So eventually when everybody returns back to their social worker offices,
everything will open up.
CFS and DPS are going to start getting all of these reports, and
yes,
it's just going to multiply.
Yeah. Across the country, there's reports that domestic violence calls are up, calls to crisis lines are up, suicide rate is up, level of depression is up, anxiety is up. So yeah, we're anticipating the need for foster parents even more so than it is right now.
Okay, so if somebody wants to call in tonight at the 888-627-6008, if you just have a question on general foster care, hey, you got the professional right here. He's going to be able to tell you. I've just played with it in the past years ago, but David is the pro at this, and he'll be glad to give you 800 numbers and places you can call, whether no matter what state you're in, but especially Ohio, he's really looking for some good parents. And can single parents be foster parents?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. We have a treatment foster care model, so it's a network, and we surround the foster home with our support staff and the clinicians, And then the other foster parents also get together as a group, as a network and a support group. So we all reach out and support one another in the foster care network.
If you could be asked on a public forum, David, and the entire country hear your words, and you have every parent on the edge of their seat listening, what would you say is the biggest need for what the parents need to focus on right now with their own kids, outside of foster care, but with their own kids? What do they need to hear? What are you seeing where the parents are lacking or dropping the ball in what's needed in our country with our children?
Wow, it's a big question, but
that's a $64,000 question.
Yeah, you know, we not to get too deep, or maybe I'll get deep, but we humans were designed to be in relationships.
Yeah,
our brains were meant to be in relationships. And our kids are experiencing what Dr. Perry refers to as relational poverty. There used to be four caring, back in the day, there used to be four caring adults for every one child.
Four for one.
Now it's the opposite. For every four children is one adult. And those are approximate.
Really?
Yeah. Our brains were designed to be in relationships, and particularly early on, children need a milieu of safe, trusting relationships that they can be involved in. It's so critical, and particularly during this pandemic when we're isolated, it's even more critical.
So, is it this stuff? Is it the phone that is keeping the parents from relationships? Is it their own personal interests? Is it TV? Is it work? Is it their own pressures? What is it that's keeping us from having relationships that have went from four to one to one to four?
Oh, I think it's all that you just mentioned. It's economics. It's when you have a single poor mother raising three children on her own, I think the average household in our country is less than three. We're isolated. We're increasingly isolated. You know, there's a lot of things factoring into it. But independence and isolation is seen, in some level, is seen as a good thing. But as we've become more isolated and more independent, we've also become more private. And as our privacy has increased, the rates of child abuse has gone up.
What's some of the things that people that live next to families, seems like our neighborhoods don't reach out anymore like we used to in the olden days. We knew who our neighbors were. We would play in the country, and that's kind of stopped. And, you know, every one of our children today need at least a champion in their life, a teacher, a coach, a friend, a neighbor, a grandma. It was in my life. It was my uncle and aunt. How important is it for neighbors to get involved in the famous Hillary Clinton, "It takes a village to raise a child" comment? How important is that?
Well, it's incredibly important. It's incredibly important. I often get the opportunity to talk to kids, former foster children who have left our programs, have aged out, they're now adults, and who are doing okay. They're making it. And I ask them, and outcome studies show this, I ask them, what made the difference? How did you make it? And some of them, or many of them, can pinpoint the moment when they knew they were going to make it because of one adult in their life touched them in some way, that emotional connection. And that could be a coach, a teacher, a minister, a doctor, who knows what it could be. So it's important, as we as adults who care about these kids, you never know when you're going to make the difference. You never know when you're going to make the difference.
You know,
and many times I tell my staff and the clinicians that, you know, they work hard and they often don't see the outcome, the fruits of their labor, because the kids leave. There's a, you know, a 25-year-old kid. It was a foster kid when he was 14. He remembers what his therapist said to him that one moment. You know, what would Johnny want me to do at this moment? you never know. So I guess you never know when you're going to have an impact on some of these foster kids. It's usually something that you didn't anticipate.
And how rewarding is that to know that? And it doesn't have to just be a social worker, worker. Because I know there's children that, I forgot who even said it, but it was something on the order that there's always a 2 to 3 people modeling their life after you, no matter whether you've asked them to or not. They're watching you and trying to become like you.
Absolutely.
And it's so important that we, I don't think I would be alive if it wasn't for my champions in my life, because it sure wasn't coming from my dad. And one for my aunt and uncle stepping up to the plate and giving me exactly what you mentioned at the first of the program, giving me that safe zone. I knew as long as I was in their presence, no one was going to hurt me.
Right.
But when I was picked up from their home, I knew that I was going to be damaged until I went back. But that's so important.
It's incredibly important.
As we turned that corner, what kind of rates is the child abuse right now? And we probably still have to talk about pre-COVID, but what kind of rates is child abuse and neglect in our country right now?
Yeah, so the last data that was published is for 2018.
Okay.
About 678,000 children in our country were deemed to be abused and neglected. 678,000.
Wow.
And another alarming statistic is about 1,700, to be exact, 1,770 children in 2018 died from abuse and neglect. So 1,700 children died from abuse and neglect. And that stat has been about the same for the last maybe 8 years. That's about 5 kids a day in our country die from abuse and neglect.
Five children a day have died because of abuse or neglect in our country.
About 4.5 kids, roughly.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's amazing, Greg, that it doesn't make the headlines. In my mind, that's the real pandemic. That's the health crisis. If we could end child abuse or bring down these child abuse rates, so many other social ills in our society and country could be taken care of. 678,000 kids.
Well, I realize that drunk driving is a problem in our country. I realize that being addicted to different medications and things is a problem in our country. But that's stuff that adults, most have, chosen to take upon them. Children shouldn't have to suffer in the manner that they're suffering. That's the one commodity, the one treasure that our country ought to surround and stand up and go, wait, enough is enough. We have to take care of our nation's most valuable resource.
Correct. So it's to drill those stats down even further, even more alarming. So of those 678,000 kids, about 29% of them are under the age of 3.
Oh, my land.
And then 15% of them are younger than 1.
Now, if that doesn't make you gut wrench and tears come up in your eyes, there's something wrong with everybody. We need to get that out.
Yeah, we need to get that word out.
You know, every president, for the last 3 presidents, I have written a long plea. Please let the first lady, the vice president, the vice president's wife, or somebody become the champion for our children. And it seems like until somebody screams loud enough, we just kind of turn a deaf ear to it.
Right.
David, have you seen anything more drastic than what has been on our front pages in the last year or two with child abuse from the Olympics, from the religious organizations, from the Boy Scouts, from, all of these places, schools and things? It just, is it always been that way, or is it just that we've become deaf to it?
I think I get that question a lot, and I think I think the sexual abuse, the physical abuse is increasing. And it often happens, well, I think it's generational.
Yes.
This isn't always the case. I say this with caution. It isn't always the case. But many times folks who are themselves abused, and if this goes untreated, they themselves become abusers. And I say that again, I say that with caution. I don't want everybody, you know, but it is, it's, I think it's a social health crisis. I think just like the pandemic that we need to step in and do something because the rates of abuse are just too high. And it has a profound impact on our country.
So to break that down a little bit more, so you're saying that the people like myself that have been abused, that go untreated, that don't admit to it and seek help and finally break through and reach out for help, we are reaping untreated generation that has been abused in the past. So it's progressively, the snowball's getting bigger as it's going farther down the hill, right?
I think so. And again, going back to what we said earlier, I think as we increasingly get isolated from each other, our privacy is increasing. We should be able to trust a coach. We should be able to trust a Cub Scout master. We should be able to trust a teacher. We have to be vigilant for our kids. We have to be vigilant for our kids.
What's available for parents out there that need help before they ever have a child? Don't you think that we ought to have some kind of, I'm not talking about a mandate education system, but something that is available? I have been screaming for years that every one of our school buildings should be filled with kids. This is all before COVID, but filled with children during the day, teaching them, educating them. And every evening, it ought to be filled with parents, teaching them and educating them how to be better parents. Is that where we have kind of dropped the ball in our society?
I think there is something to that. I think, again, we've become so isolated and we're so siloed. Social workers are with social workers, doctors are with doctors, psychiatrists are with psychiatrists, third graders are with third graders, fifth graders are with fifth graders. I think we've lost the idea of what you alluded to earlier. We don't, we're isolated from each other, and kids aren't exposed to different age groups, and kids aren't exposed to different generations so that they can help raise the younger siblings or their cousins and to live with grandma and grandpa and their parents. It's a complicated topic, but I would say that we need to get parenting into the schools, how to parent into the schools for everybody, not just a few. And we need to start taking mental health seriously.
I do believe to have a little bit of sunlight in the middle of what we've been talking about, a pretty dark subject, that I do believe mental health is starting to become placed under the microscope. I think there's a lot of people going, hey, wait, mental health isn't something to be ashamed of. It's something to embrace and stand up and go, wait, I have issues. Because we all have mental health issues to a certain extent.
Yeah. For some reason, the way that our educational system has been designed, we disconnect the brain from the rest of the body. It all is connected, you know, and the brain impacts everything that we do. And mental health is a real thing. And we have to, you're right, there has been some lifting of the stigma around mental health in the country.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take our last break. If you want to have a comment or a question, feel free to post that on Facebook or to call at 888-627-6008. And I think, David, you kind of kicked us right into a perfect segue into the impact of that abuse and neglect on the developing brain. And I don't know, I kind of want to throw this out at you because I didn't tell you anything we were going to talk about up front, but have you heard about the new research that's happening in the womb of how the impact of what the mother's going through and how it's impacting the child before it's ever developed? I'm going to kind of pick your brain to see if you have any wisdom on that, because I am fascinated with that subject too. So be with us. We're going to take our last break right now. If you want to call in at 888-627-6008, and we'll be right back. It'll be about a minute and 13 seconds on the other side of this commercial break. We'll be right back for another segment of Breaking the Time.
HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers A Child Called It and The Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back to the final segment of Breaking the Silence. And yeah, the Shattered by the Darkness book, you know, it's selling better this last week or two than it has last year. So I don't know what's going on. They may have it on sale on Amazon or something. I don't know. But anyway, feel free to pick that up. And the newest book's going to be coming out here shortly. We're working hard to get that out. And I want to tell you, David from the Village Network from Ohio is with us tonight. And the model that you have with the one important model that you have with Dr. Bruce Perry, is so highly recognized and respected. Was that a hard choice to make, or was it just a slam dunk? Why did you choose to involve Dr. Perry's work?
That's a great question. So we were running some residential programs as we do now. And back then they were the typical residential program. It was loud, chaotic. Some of these children are so impulsive that they get aggressive. So there's physical restraints. So we were looking for models that would somehow help us figure out how to just get better outcomes. And I can't even remember how it happened, but I went to a presentation of Dr. Perry's at OU, Ohio University, and we were hooked. He explained to us why we were having a difficult time, why we weren't getting better outcomes than we should have been. Since using that model, the neurosequential model of therapeutics, in some of our programs, we've had, in one program, we had 87% reduction in the need for physical restraints. So we went down. We had one program had 212 restraints in 1 year. We went down to 3. And that same program, another year, had 0. And along with that were other results, such as fewer hospitalizations, fewer running away. There was fewer kids hurting themselves. And the NMT is able to give us a framework and an assessment to truly work with the children developmentally where they're at developmentally, which has made a huge difference.
You know, I remember those days of having to put children in physical restraints. And we called it back in those days in the Boytown model that we used in our residential home was 5-second rule. We would scream out, and my kids would know what that meant. Yeah, my little children, 2 or 3 years old, 5-second rule, they'd run back to the apartment and close the door. That meant everybody needed to be in the room, and we're having a face-off with the one child that is raging, and to have to put that child in a restraint is the most heart-wrenching thing, because they're completely out of control. And we had to literally give them simple instructions to bring them back under control.
Correct, right.
Set up. Set on the couch. Move to that end of the couch. And when they finally started following orders, then yep. everything would start calming down. Is that kind of the system that you still have now? Or what did Dr. Perry say, hey, different ballgame?
Well, no, exactly what you were describing, and I'm familiar with the five-second rule. I'm somewhat familiar with that model. And the reason you were trained to use simple words is because the child was escalated. And when children are escalated, they're actually in the lower parts of their brain. They're in the brainstem. They're not in the upper parts of the brain. Our smart part of our brain is up in our cortex. But when we're triggered, when we're escalated, when we're frightened, we go down to our brainstem, and we can't process complicated sentences or instructions.
I'm going to stop you there. So when a child is enraged, highly stressed in your home, if there's parents listening to this right now, if a child is at that point where they're throwing things or they're cussing and they're putting their fist through the wall, how much help does it do for me as a parent to get my finger in your face and yell and scream even louder? Does it help at all, or is it putting?
No, it makes things worse. It makes things worse.
Now, finish what you were going to say, because it needs to help us bring that thought process back to the top of their brain.
Exactly. So everything, and all the incoming stimulation goes in through the brainstem first, and the brain processes from the bottom to the top. If we're so dysregulated, that material will never make it to the cortex. You won't be able to process it, you know, in a way that is helpful, in a way that you can problem solve. What you're saying, a dysregulated adult cannot de-escalate a dysregulated child. We, the adults, have to stay regulated, because children regulate off of us. And we teach this with our teachers too. Dr. Perry has the neurosequential model in education. Threatening a child to say you're going to lose your privileges, you got to go to bed early. It may feel like it might be the right thing to say, but in fact, it's escalating the situation.
So does the parent become a thermostat?
Exactly.
If I turn up the temperature, this is going to get worse. If Absolutely. I turn it down, eventually they will come back down. Absolutely. The rage will.
Yeah, the best foster parents and the best child care workers I've seen, the staff are in our residential programs. The best child care workers are the ones that they walk into the facility, they walk out into the living environment, they don't say a word. Just by their mere presence, the kids feel safer. Because some of these folks and I bet you've seen them, they have the way about carrying themselves. They feel confident. They give off the feel that I'm in charge and I will take care of you and I'll do whatever it takes to keep you safe. And when children feel safe, they can come down, they can get regulated, and they can actually process things and problem solve with the adults.
So in the environment of, while we're on the subject of rage and anger, is the rage and anger that comes up in a child typically about what the issue is at the time, or is it something that is completely separate about what's happened to them in the past, and it's just being bottled up and it finally spews out?
Boy, that's a complicated question. So one of the things that we've learned, the field has learned in more recent years, is that one of the results of early childhood abuse and neglect is it compromises the child's ability to control their impulses. It compromises their ability to control their impulses, their thoughts, and their feelings. We regulate ourselves by using our top part of our brain, the cortex. It's called executive functioning, is one way to put it. We use the top part of our brain to control the impulses coming out of lower parts of our brain. But if a child experienced what we're calling now developmental trauma, their lower parts of the brain are disorganized. They might be weakened. So they have impulses coming out of their brainstem. And because the brain develops from the top to the bottom and it develops sequentially, the top part of the brain could be compromised as well. And that ability to perform executive function, or that ability to control your impulses, is compromised. So a child could, to answer you,
I'm loving this.
So you might be a child who was physically abused, and when you were younger, and just for whatever reason, the abuser got a smart aleck look on his face and got a smile just before he hit you, right? Cruel, right? Years later, you're with an adult, maybe a childcare worker or a foster parent, and they get a smile on their face that could trigger the child. And that trigger then, because they have a compromised executive functioning, they get dysregulated and they get impulsive. And they seemingly are triggered for something that you didn't have any idea what you just did.
Well, that's powerful, because I'm looking at my own life. Being abused for, I don't know how many years, at least 17 years, as long as I can remember, it's my childhood, up to almost 17 years old, daily. I have trouble regulating certain things in my brain today. So I control that by over-regulating the things that I can control. So I have OCD issues. I will control this pencil. And if, you know, I have a pen, if I'm lying, I'm dying. I have a pen at my desk that I have used for the last almost 10 years of being in Baylor College of Medicine. A doctor came in and signed some paperwork for me, accidentally put my pen in their pocket. It's a cheap, big pen. I went absolutely bonkers until I ran that doctor down and said, hey, wait, you took my pen. You took my 29-cent pen that I think I got free. You took my pen. Can I have it back? Oh, yeah, I don't want this. What do you want this for? Because that's my baby. I control that. And I don't think people understand the impact of what abuse does to the developing brain of a child.
Yeah. You know, in the mental health field and the trauma field, there's a lot of ironic things that take place. But one of the biggest things, the developmental trauma takes, usually the abuse takes place in the context of somebody who should be caring for that child, right? Mm. It takes place in the midst of a relationship. But the hard part about that, and the ironic piece of that, is in order for that child to heal, they have to be in a relationship. So we're asking kids who've been abused and neglected in the midst of a relationship to enter into another relationship, and we're asking them to trust us. And that's extremely difficult and challenging.
What seems to be the biggest challenge in building that trust with a child that has a trust, a lack of trust in a parent? What do you think is the establishing foundation that you have to make with that child to start building upon that?
It's really important for the adults and the activities and the programs in that child's life to be consistent and repetitive, structured.
Absolutely.
If it's Tuesday at 2 o'clock and whatever's supposed to be happening on Tuesday at 2 o'clock, let's make sure that's happening. The same thing every day, consistency, the adults being persistent and respectful, having more tolerance than the child. Many of these kids will, as you get closer to them, they will have almost a instinctual or guttural response to push you away. You know, it's true that they want to hurt you before you're going to hurt them, because they expect you to hurt them. We, the adults who are treating these children, taking care of them, we have to be able to tolerate that.
Yeah.
And keep them safe while they're trying to push us away.
And you know, do you find that as they're pushing you away, they want to be the first one to hurt themselves before you do it? I'll beat you to the punch.
Yes,
David. I mean, I'll beat you to it. I'll hurt myself before I let you hurt me. Do you find that?
Or I'll give you reason to be mad at me.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
There was something I was going to say with that when you had that. That was so good. When the kids deal with parents, I think one of my biggest frustrations and misunderstandings back in those days as being a foster parent was we wanted to raise the kids. They always wanted to return back to the parent that was hurting them. And yeah, I couldn't understand that. Why? It's going to be safe here. And they would always say, because that's my dad or that's my mom.
Right.
So how do you help with that?
So it speaks to the power. One, it speaks to the power of relationships and that first foundational primary relationship that the child has with their parent is an incredible, incredible bond. That adage, blood is thicker than water. Many of the children, when they leave foster care, they in fact go back to their parents. So this has been a fairly new recognition over the last several years in the field. We need to engage the families of these children. We need to engage. They need help too, these families. And it's not, we've gotten it wrong throughout the years to automatically blame the family. That adage I said, that saying I said that kids do well if they can, well, we're finding the families of these children do well if they can. Yeah. And if they can't, we have to figure out what's getting in their way and get the parents into treatment.
You know, when pre-COVID, I was traveling around the country and talking to a lot of teachers, and I found myself in front of a lot of parents a lot of times. And yeah. I would kind of get, not irate, but I would kind of get loud with the parents. You know, I'd tell the parents, hey, folks, it's not your job to be your child's best friend. It's your job to be their parent. Children right. are screaming and need discipline. Do they not all need perimeters? And when they don't have that, they don't feel safe?
Children need boundaries. They need they need boundaries. They need consistent expectations. Yes. And along with that, they need reward. And I'm not saying reward in the sense of if you do this, you get a cookie. I'm talking about the and we learned this from Dr. Perry, the neurobiological pleasure you feel from being in relationships. So what is it like? I often tell teachers that feeling you get when that third grader finally looks at you and gets the math equation, finally. And that look in their eyes, that's the pleasure I'm talking about. When they know that they are making the child's making you proud.
Yeah.
That's the reward that has to take place and the pleasure that has to take place along with the consistent expectation and structures that the children need.
How many positive comments to negatives do they recommend now with a child?
That's really interesting. I know what you're talking about because in the teaching family model, right? They say, I think it was 4-1.
Yeah.
You know, we don't even talk in those terms anymore.
Really?
We talk, could be a whole nother topic or a whole nother show. We have removed from all of our programs the reward level systems and the point sheets and the.
Yeah, we had to write them down.
I remember that. Yeah, everything is, all that has been removed and everything is about. Safety and the child's and the relationship with the child.
Wow.
That's great.
David, tell you what, this has been fascinating tonight. I appreciate so much. I knew this hour would just fly by and we get a lot of comments on my phone and texts are being popping up here. I just appreciate you coming in. If somebody is, let's take it just in Ohio right now. If somebody's interested in the state of Ohio that we have a lot of listeners in that wants to get in touch with you about becoming, they don't have to commit right now, but just thinking right. about it, I have questions and thoughts about becoming a foster parent. I may be considering it. How would they get in touch with you from Ohio perspective?
They can call us. We have an 800 number. It's 800-638-3232. Or they can go to our website, thevillagenetwork.org. And there's a place there on our website to contact us, but it's 800-638-3232.
638-3232, an 800 number. And the Village Network website is very, very good. I enjoyed looking through that. Okay, now if somebody else in another part of the country, same way? Is that the best
thing? Yes, call, give us, no matter where you're at, call our 800 number, and we will connect you to the right people.
Fantastic. If somebody just wants to reach out to you, David, is there you wanted to reach out through the Village Network, through your email there?
They can dpaxton@thevillagenetwork.com.
So dpaxton, P-A-X-T-O-N, @thevillagenetwork.com.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Well, David, thank you for Grandpa David. Thank you for being with us tonight, and I appreciate it. This has been fascinating. It's brought up a lot of great memories that I've had, and I want to let you know, and you know, but the people that's listening, I'm not for sure I've done anything more rewarding than being a foster parent for those children that I have done over the past, and that was something that was very gratifying. It may not be immediate gratification, but it sure is when you see those children return back home or become successful in their life. And I appreciate the work that you're doing. Thank you for sharing your time with us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
We appreciate it. We'll be in touch soon. Thank you, David. As we close out every program each week, we want to let you know that next week's guest is going to be James Brown, a friend of mine, is going to be here and talk about situations that he's been involved with in his life, how he's overcome them, and what he's going to do with the rest of his life because of what he's gone through. It's going to be a great program. But each week, I always like to close out, take a few seconds just to say, no matter where you're at right now, no matter what you're going through, no matter how dark it looks outside or inside of what you're dealing with right now, there's always hope. You have hope. Reach out, call me, email me, text me, whatever. We'll get you help. But if you need some help, I just want to let you know it's there for you, and there's always hope for you. Join us right here next week, 8 p.m. Central Time, live from the most beautiful city in the world, Houston, Texas, for another edition of Breaking the Silence. Have an awesome week. Enjoy your Labor Day weekend. God bless you, and stay safe. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.